Welcome to the Catchcast slot, where we are reliving a few of the most popular shows while I'm off chairing an international transit mapping symposium, like you do. Today we're replaying the second most popular episode on the podcast website. It's the one that was all about railway auctions. The show was only broadcast in September, but it's garnered a lot of attention when we spoke with Simon Turner of GWRA.co.uk about those amazing auctions selling off old railway memorabilia. In this edition, we're finding out why auctions for old railway relics are so hugely popular. We hear about what's raising the big prices, how you can take part right here on the island, and what you might even sell for yourself. Today we're joined by auctioneer and collector Simon Turner of GWRA.co.uk. Welcome to the Catchcast, sir.
Hello, Mark. Yeah, it's Simon Turner here from GW Railway Honour Auctions, the leading auction house for railway memorabilia within the UK and actually now the world.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us on the show, Simon. And we really want to know all about your life as an auctioneer and the wonderful things that you sell. But I want to be a bit cheeky and take you back to something earlier on in your life and to ask how you got interested in auctioneering and also railways and transport.
Yeah, okay. Well, it sort of started for me probably as a six-year-old when my parents bought me a model railway. And from then onwards, I sort of got fascinated with steam engines in those days, although I sort of just missed them with my sort of age, and gradually I sort of expanded the model railway. And then probably when I was about 13, family holiday took us to the Lake District, and actually in the mid 70s the opening of the National Railway Museum in York, and my parents thought it would be a good idea to take me there. And out the front of York Station was a shop selling railway relics, and I persuaded my parents to buy me a signal arm. So my first item was a signal arm, which we carried through York, and that started. And then from then onwards, as a schoolboy, I took one of the early magazines that featured railway relics and got interested in it, and just gradually bought bits willy-nilly, really. No focus, just anything to do with railways. Found a few signs, and gradually through the 70s sort of got the odd bit. My first sort of station sign was 1978, and I was about 15, and I waltzed up to Worcester Shrub Hill, which is one of our local stations, and I'd heard it was being re-signed, and I knocked on the door and I said, could I buy one? And they weren't for sale just at that particular time, but the station manager came down and he had one that had fallen off, so I managed to buy that one for a princely sum of £5 plus the VAT. That started me off, and really it just carried on like that through the sort of late 70s and 80s. When I moved into my first house, I met my future business partner in the auctions, who literally by chance had moved in five doors down the road. So one of those lifetime sort of chance meetings that spawned into something else.
Nice. And I wonder if you can explain to the listeners what the term railway owner actually means.
I think it was a term coined in the 70s by some of the pioneers of the railway owner collecting circle. It was a term a bit like people have called pub stuff brewery owner. It's a colloquial term used for railway memorabilia. It usually refers to the hardware, I think, not the ephemera or tickets. So it's really a name for railway issued hardware. So not models, official railway items that were usually hardware.
Got you. Okay. Now, you've explained how you managed to collect some early railway honour, and yep. I believe that apart from the enamels, you also have a bit of an interest nowadays in the old railway clocks. Is that right?
Yeah. Me personally, I've always been mechanically minded, so my hobbies were not only railway honour, but motorcycle restoration as well. Mm-hmm. And I remember my business partner buying a railway clock, and I was sort of fascinated, and I literally went to the library, got a book out on clocks and sort of read up about it. I've got that kind of mind, and then managed to acquire my first one in the early 90s. Then took it apart, cleaned it, and then from then onwards decided I was going to sort of restore them as well. So went up to the shop in York, which had opened by British Rail, not the early one, but this was a later one in the 90s, and I bought four old railway clocks, 19th century clocks. They were pretty poorly, and they were my sort of practice pieces, and taught myself how to repair them. I was always good at woodwork, so that wasn't a problem. And gradually I built up a business as well that repairs and restores railway clocks, and that's still online now, but with the auction business growing so large, it's something I have to do when I can sort of fit it in. But it is something I quite enjoy, and it just uses a different part of your skill set, I think.
Nice. So before the rise of the internet, and we'll come on to talk about your website in a little while, but before all that, how did people actually find these wonderful old relics then?
There were various sort of small magazines. We got some coverage as a hobby within some of the major railway magazines in the earlier days. So there were some collector's journals that were produced by a couple of people that went out to all the railway memorabilia collectors. There were a couple of bigger auctions in those days, that one of them was in Sheffield, and the gentleman who owned that was quite good. I mean, he sort of brought it to the masses by sort of older means, by contacting newspapers, and gradually it became a bit more mainstream, and that's where we came in 30 years ago, really. And we felt we wanted to sort of, as the new boys on the block, we had to be different. So we've always been fairly sort of technologically based. My business partner, he came from a radio and telecommunications background, and I came from a business-to-business kind of sales background, and we used our sort of skill sets to do that. So we were the first with computer invoicing by a long way in our line of work. In fact, some of my smaller competitors today still do what I call sort of fag packet invoicing, which is just basically handwriting stuff. Hey, I mean, this day and age, you've got to be computerised. And you hit on the internet. Well, we were the first on the net. I say my business partner, that was his sort of area of knowledge to a degree, telecommunications, and he, long before I got on the net, he realised that was the way forward, and actually wrote our first website. Later on I got involved with that, and once I sort of taught myself, and I'm sort of responsible now for the website you see today. The actual layout of it, I mean, was after my business partner had retired. I felt we needed to have something a little bit more up to date, that's easily navigable, and trying to think about the kind of people we're aiming it at so they can navigate through it. It's become the go-to website now for a lot of journalists. I get a lot of requests for photographs from people writing books, which I'm more than happy to share with, you know. I mean, the whole idea of the website, even after I've maybe retired from the business, is that it will still keep running, and it's a wonderful thing to get information from. The whole idea is that I'm passionate also about fakes. So with my business, I've got a very good eye. I've done it a long time, and I started a Facebook group up a few years ago purely for fakes, to try and educate people about that kind of thing.
We're going to discuss more about the site in a bit, Simon, but I just wonder if you could tease us a little bit maybe with one of your perhaps best-selling items.
It's the world record holder for a piece of railway armour, which is actually the original nameplate of Flying Scotsman. I think I can dine out on that one for a long time. It was a total shock at the time when we sold it. There's a YouTube video. Yeah, it surprised me. It made 64,500 hammer.
Whoa!
And, yeah. For me, it was a sort of, pinnacle. It took a long time to auction. I think the whole thing took 10 minutes. We had the BBC there with cameras, and yeah, it was one of those moments that I was extremely sort of blown away with, really.
Amazing. Who would have thought that an old piece of railway relic would fetch so much? Do you think there are many people who've got those kind of things in the shed somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. The biggest growth area for us now in the last sort of 4 years have been the actual original station signs, named station signs. The island is extremely collectible, so anything named off the island is just highly desirable. I mean, people still remember it for holidays. A lot of the stuff we sell can be related to holidays, so there's certain areas that are extremely desirable. people. So the Island is one of them. The old Somerset and Dorset line that ran from Bath down to Bournemouth, where a lot of people took that on holiday in the 50s and 60s, it, once again, is another highly collectible line.
So if you find something in the shed, get in touch with you.
Absolutely, yeah. It will certainly give you a sensible valuation. I've got customers in the Island that collect. We're used to dealing with the Island. Yeah, anything with a name that's related to the Island, even if it's sort of reasonably modern. I mean, I've just sold three Network Southeast carriage prints, which are sort of fairly modern, you know, within the last 20 years or so. They've actually gone really well. So even the more modern stuff, if it's got decent sort of images of the Island or whatever, yeah, they do go for a lot of money over here.
Simon, you've nicely set the scene for us about your background and launching the site, but I wonder if you could maybe just muse with me a bit about why old railway relics are just so incredibly popular right now.
Yeah, they've been popular for a long time. A lot of the earlier pieces, like the steam-related stuff, you have to go back to the age group that were train spotters back in the 1950s. You know, now they're sort of probably in their sort of 70s, 80s, and they just sort of want a piece of memory from their sort of youth. And that's been one of the driving things with the steam era, which sadly is sort of gradually slowing down. We have seen quite a lot of shifts in pricing over the last sort of 5 years, sadly. You know, the steam era is gradually dropping, but it's being replaced with other things. So one of our highest sort of growth areas, or our two highest growth areas, have been now, funnily enough, diesel and electric related items, and also the station signs from the sort of 50s, 60s and whatever. So it's not doom and gloom with it. It's just keeping sort of abreast with the market. It's something we've managed to do quite well. The last sort of three auctions have been our highest ever grossing. In times where people say, oh, well, there's not much collateral money around, but there actually is for people who got a passion for these things. And there's such a lot of depth to railway honour that you don't have to buy the whole caboodle. People tend to collect, sort of hone in and collect certain areas.
So, you've described the fact that perhaps the old steam loco period is maybe slightly on the wane, but you've said
it is
that,
on the wane.
Yeah, but the enamel signs that were used for the station names, they're still fetching good prices, are they?
Yeah, we've seen some record prices. In fact, a couple of years ago, we set the world record for an enamel British Rail station sign, which was Cree and Larrick. That made a staggering 30,000. And only in July, we now got number two spot with the station enamel sign, which made 15,500. And that was a place called Great Stone on Sea, which is a very small station down on the Sussex coast, which surprised me. I think our vendor, we talked about a 4,000 reserve on the item. We use our expertise to help people with putting reserves on. We're sensible about it. And then, yeah, I literally had a phone call from that vendor yesterday morning thanking me. It's always quite nice to get some feedback from vendors. We like to think we do a good job, but it's always nice to get that.
So when did those signs get put up then originally? And can you sort of describe what they look like maybe?
Well, the Southern Railway, who ran the services on the Island up to the grouping in 1948, had an enamel station sign that was basically a circle with a bar through it. We call those Southern Railway targets. Most of the Island was signed with that kind of sign. Highly desirable. Most make thousands of pounds from the Island. And then in 1948, when British Railways became the owning company, they designed a station sign which we call totems, which is basically, some people call them hot dogs. Now, for the Island, there were only two stations that actually had those, and one was Newport, and the other one, strangely enough, was Mill Hill. I've been lucky enough in the past to own a Newport. Never seen a Mill Hill come up for sale. You know, that would be a highly desirable one. Once again, thousands of pounds, so hopefully that explains what they look like.
Yeah, and I imagine apart from the enamel signs, there are also other items that are quite popular. What about things like posters?
Yeah, posters are timeless. They're sort of judged as artwork, really. And anywhere that's advertised, you know, a nice, pretty, well-executed pictorial poster, especially of holiday locations. So once again, Devon, Cornwall, the island, Sussex coast, anywhere seaside ones, the east coast, they are sort of quite collectible for that. And if they're a holiday location, they just sort of appeal to a much wider audience than sort of, let's say, one of where I live, Evesham. You know, it's going to appeal to me, of course, but not everybody. So anyone's where holidays are involved, they've always got a higher appeal. Certain artists, again, more desirable than others. It's all down to personal preference.
And how broad does collecting Railway Arna go? I can understand people buying loco and station nameplates and even old posters, but what other kind of things do you sell?
Absolutely huge. I mean, you know, I've got something, I think, on our system around about sort of 70 plus categories. So you've got chinaware, silverware, glassware, instruments out of the signal boxes, the little lever plates and things that went on the signal levers. I've got all the works plates from not only steam locomotives but diesel and electric, the little tokens that were used on the single line, they've got names on, so that just literally anything with names on, you know, official railway items that have actually got name places on are always going to be more desirable than ones that are just generic.
So if you find an old railway ticket or piece of enamel or a timetable or a lamp knocking around, what should you do with it?
I think with the ephemera side, don't call me. we don't do sort of ephemeral tickets, but yeah, you've mentioned a lamp. The first thing I would look for on a lamp is what's actually stamped on it, what owning company. If it's a BR one, it's going to be pretty common, but if it's got an earlier company on there, then the prices can go up. I've sold the odd lamp for £2,000 or £3,000, but it has to be the right one.
Simon, you've done a great job explaining to us what Railway Arna is and just how collectible old train relics are. Can you tell us a bit more about how the actual process of an auction works?
Yeah, by all means. Literally, it starts off with us getting contacted by the vendor. We'll probably give them an idea of how much the items are worth, whether they're suitable for us to sell. If they're not suitable for us to sell, I'll give them some advice on what they can do with them, so we don't sort of leave them in the cold. So basically, we will then get the items here. I will then check them over, photograph them, describe them, catalogue them onto our system. And then once we've got all the auction catalogued on our back office system, we'll then allocate the actual lot numbers. I tend to do that literally once we've got them all on. I'll go through the whole thing, spend a day, and try and move things around so we get a nice balance to the actual auction. It's no good just sort of having all the good stuff in 10 minutes because, you know, my job is to try and keep people engaged on the online platform. We run it now purely as an online auction over 2 days on a Saturday and Sunday with roughly about 1,000 lots.
Wow.
I do roughly about 100 lots an hour, so we're pretty swift. We run it on the major sort of platform for online bidding. We were doing that before COVID. We used to actually rent out the local high school and get an audience of actually bums on seats of about 400 to 500.
Wow.
But we also ran it online, once again, as I said about GWRA, we've always been fairly proactive in new technology, and we introduced online bidding in conjunction with the room a long time ago. And then unfortunately when COVID hit, as the business owner, it sort of threw me into all sorts of thoughts, but I felt we could actually do what we needed to do. And we still produce a printer catalogue as well, so all the printers and various people were working obviously during COVID where they could, so I felt we could sort of pull it off. And this was the great thing, I think, about GWRA. We were able to actually perform a live broadcast auction to an audience that were basically sat at home, missing their sort of fix of Railway Arna. Over the COVID period, we were one of those businesses which actually grew, which sadly not everyone did, but we did. And we got a lot of praise from the customer base. They really enjoyed it. They felt they hadn't lost out everything. It was really good. And from then onwards, we sort of grew a bit more. We probably grew by about 30%. So instead of doing 500 lots in a main auction or 600, we actually ended up doing 1,000. It's never cast in tablets of stone, but we've certainly achieved that in the last sort of couple of years. And I looked at it and felt, actually, this isn't sort of broke now, so I don't need to fix it. So we decided we wouldn't go back to the room. And it's worked really well, and people enjoy it. And a lot of my customers now have got to the age where they don't really want to get up at the crack of dawn, travel 2.5-3 hours in a car. So it's enabled us to keep them engaged without having to travel. And now they can travel if they bought something post-auction to pick it up. You know, we're pretty flexible on that.
Well, how good to hear that a business has actually grown from COVID. So how about a few tips then? If there was something in your catalogue that I like the look of, do we wait to the end of the bidding or do we get one in early? What's the best way to do it?
That's really down to the person. I personally, if I'm bidding, let's say in another auction, if I want something, I tend to wait to the end. I tend to wait until it's live on the day. Our catalogue goes live on the internet roughly about 4 weeks before each sale, and people can bid then and leave bids on the online system. Some people like to do that. They can then forget about it. If they get outbid, they've given it their best shot, or some actually just literally sit by the computer and a bit like a game of poker, they'll sort of bid when they feel they ought to come in and carry on bidding until they exhaust it. I mean, my advice as an auctioneer and as a collector is never get too carried away. You'll only regret it if you've spent too much on something. So always have a figure in your mind where you want to go to. And I think if I was giving a bit of advice to somebody to bid, maybe get that figure and maybe go one or two more. Don't get carried away, because I've done it in the past as a collector and you never love that piece. You know, you always think, oh, I've probably stretched the boat out too far. So just using a bit of common sense. I mean, when our auction is actually on the internet, pre-sale, we do put start prices in there. We don't use estimates, because I feel an estimate, it's a strange thing, really. Some people get an idea, if you put an estimate, that that's what it's worth. Well, it's not. That's just a thought of the auction house. And I quite often see other auction houses using very low estimates, maybe to just bring people in. So our start prices, they're roughly 20% below maybe the reserve or the target figure. So it gets people sort of into it without thinking they're going to get some of these estimates are way below what they ought to be.
Now, is this an area that's just something of interest to UK rail fans?
No, we do broadcast globally. I occasionally get buyers from Australia, America, Germany. Occasionally, I've had one or two in Japan. So some of those will be expats, but there are ones that are not. So it's not a huge global thing, but if you get the right pieces, and posters have been one of those things over the years that the American market has tapped into. But the actual auction is broadcast on a platform which does reach outside of the UK, so you never know.
I noticed a fantastic photograph of you with hundreds of those beautiful totems laid flat on the ground, and you literally laying on the floor in between them all. It completely begs the question, where the heck do you store all these beautiful items before each sale, Simon?
Well, basically, I'm lucky that we've got plenty of storage on site at my house, really, so we run it all from home. I've got business insurance to cover me here, obviously a decent alarm and CCTV system. But I like that idea, because I don't want to be going outside of here to go to lockups or storage areas, because if somebody does want to come and have a look at something, they're more than welcome pre-sale as long as they book in. They can't come and view everything, but if they say they want to view X or Y, then we're pretty flexible on that. One of the things I'm quite passionate about is good photography as well. So my photography, as I say, has been used by quite a lot of people for books and things. And I feel, and this was something that came out of COVID as well, that at the end of the day, you're selling something on a photograph and a description, and they've got to be as good as they can be. So we're using pretty good photographic equipment. I'm not using a camera phone. I'm using sort of a digital SLR with a prime lens, and my descriptions always include the condition of the item. And people trust GWRA now because they know I've got a good eye and I don't sort of beat around the bush. If something's not right, let's say something comes here and I find out that item isn't what it's supposed to be, it won't be sold. We do not sell reproductions at all, and that's always been our policy.
I mean, people need to see every little minor scratch and scuff, don't they, really?
Do, and certainly with our photos. I mean, you know, I'm taking them, as I say, with a decent quality digital SLR, and I take them in RAW as well, so I can adjust the sort of photo as far as exposure goes, and I keep a file of RAW images, so if people do want an even higher res one, I can always email that.
And what a beautiful record that is for history as well.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, I think that's one thing I've been keen about. When I retire a couple of years, my business will be going to another collector who's going to take it on, but he's buying a wonderful piece of history with all those photos as well. Things like Google love us. The website's absolutely huge now. Literally thousands and thousands of HTML pages. Each lot is an HTML page, so it's nicely Google optimized, and yeah, it's great.
Well, it always comes up when I search for a railway relic.
That's the idea.
Oh, nice one. Well, last thing I've got to ask you, as a bit of a rail fan yourself, do you ever want to keep all of these items that have been submitted to you?
Yeah, I mean, people ask me that. I mean, as a collector myself, I've got a nice collection. I've got what I want to a degree, without going silly, you know. But it's quite nice. I get a moving collection with this as well. So it's always quite nice. I think the nicest thing is when a member of the public comes along and they find something in Grandad's shed and they've got no idea at all. And part of my expertise is to give them an estimate, and some of them can be quite shocked. You know, I remember a gentleman a few years ago bought a house and he found a little plate in the garden shed. He was going to throw it away. His son-in-law said no, contacted us. We immediately realised it was an exceptional piece. You know, we said about 6,000 and it made 10,000. So
wow.
It's a bit like, yeah, you know, and for me, it gives me a great buzz if I'm actually helping people that, you know, some of it can be life-changing. I've had one or two where it has been life-changing for people who've inherited items that they didn't really know what they had, and it literally has, you know.
Wow. Well, this really has been a fascinating whistle-stop tour of the world of railway honour and the joys of auctions. So thank you so much, Simon Turner of GWRA, for doing this and joining us on the Catchcast. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mark.
You can find more on the GW Railway Honour Auctions website at gwra.co.uk. And there are, of course, other auction houses online. Hope you've enjoyed listening to this as much as I have. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. Please join us then.